welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rea, and I'm joined for the purposes of this intro once again by Mr. David Holmes and producer Miles. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are we both doing?
Yeah, I'm not so bad. It's how about you, Miles?
No, very good after that session. Lots of feedback flooding in already. There was, as people may note, a bit of confusion at the start of the session with the invites going out, but it ended up being one of our busiest GDPR radios in a while. I think we had about 80 participants live there.
I'd like to start slightly differently, because we normally say it's a really good session, and you, in essence, sometimes you think, well, we're bound to say that. I actually found this a bit of a tricky session, because there's a couple of really kind of difficult topics. Quite a few sensitivities around it, so I actually found it quite a difficult session, and hopefully we've navigated the sensitivities well, but I found it quite difficult because of the nature of the topics.
That's a very good point, Dave, and I mean, it's a very, very interesting conversation, but it's as you say, a tricky one. And I think it's worth pointing out here at this point, if you're listening to this back, just a bit of a content or a trigger warning. We do discuss some quite difficult subjects, including specifically abortion rights, labour and pregnancy, which I appreciate. Well, we all appreciate can be very difficult topics. So we thought we'd point it out. Unfortunately, there aren't really timestamps for that. So if you'd rather avoid those subjects, we suggest we wouldn't normally do this, but we'd suggest that you skip the episode in its entirety, especially as we spend a long time talking about them. But you know, obviously the focus isn't those specific issues, it's the privacy considerations around them, but they are interlinked fundamentally. So we just thought it was worth pointing that out at the top, didn't we? But a very, very interesting conversation, all about constitutional privacy rights. And not just that, we also spoke about some slightly more lighthearted bits. I say lighthearted, there's a breach at University of Essex this week that we spoke about. And also bits that the FBI have been doing in terms of surveillance. Not that lighthearted, but more so than the other topics, possibly.
I guess we ended on a lighthearted rant for myself in relation to partly reading and also partly sharing information more widely from a corporate social responsibility, or at least kind of a staff welfare point around cyber threats and how they can protect themselves in the personal capacity.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's a worthwhile point. So we do hope you enjoyed that conversation. Just a few bits before we let you get into the main body of it. The first is that, well, first of all, if you enjoy these sessions, as we've been saying for the last couple of weeks, do feel free to let us know to what extent you enjoy them by leaving us a review. You can do that either on the podcast platform of your choice, or you can head to Trustpilot. We'll leave a link in all of the recordings. You know, name drop Dave and I, whatever you do, because it helps us along. Producer Miles has got us doing a competition in Tilly for the most Trustpilot reviews. So why don't you help us out if you enjoy the podcast? And to be fair, if you've got any feedback at all for how we can improve this, for instance, this week I'm using a slightly more professional setup in terms of the mic. If there are things like that you enjoy, things that you think we could improve on, if you've got specific suggestions for the format, the tone, etc., whatever it might be, do get in touch with us. We find that it's a format and you know, a feed that we really enjoy, isn't it, Dave? It's something that we value highly, and if we can improve that, we're always looking in ways that we can maybe improve it.
For sure, and for me, just on that point, and I know the intro is a bit short. For me, the main thing is really that we are serious about trying to build a community. So it's not just saying how can you improve it for us, as in Ollie and myself, but it's how we can improve for others, whether it's content-wise, whether it's how we come across, whether it's elements to include, that kind of thing. So it's how could we improve the community, and not just Ollie and I. Ollie and I, as Miles will vouch, we more or less talk, have an opinion on most things. We can talk around most things.
Yes.
So please feel free to advise and guide if you think it's going to be for the greater benefit of the community.
Absolutely. I very much concur, Dave. Right, well, before we let the listeners get stuck into this,
I could possibly say we're looking for things that might be of interest to the community and not necessarily in the community interest.
You're a menace, you, honestly. Listener, that'll make sense to you when you get into the main body of this. Dave, as you well know, is is notorious for his mischief. And even though we had a heavier session this week, that's certainly not changed. Although apparently, Dave, that's part of the reason the listeners keep coming back. So keep doing what you're doing, by the sounds of it. People were asking after you while you're away. So before we let you get stuck into this this session, listener, it's just worth pointing out that there was slight confusion around this, because this was originally billed as retention and archiving, which we had to change because of a booking issue. So this is an episode of GDPR Radio, informal, you know the drill by now, opportunity to discuss some privacy topics and elements from the news from the week that Dave and I have been working on. But retention and archiving hasn't gone anywhere. It's just happening next week. The reason we've had to move it is because we wanted Carrie to join us. You may be familiar with Carrie. She's been on a couple of episodes before. We love having her on the podcast. She's really, really quite good on them. But in particular, retention and archiving, because I believe that Carrie has a degree in records management and archiving, or something akin to that. I certainly don't want to set her up to fail on this, but I'm fairly certain that she's quite experienced. And we're really looking forward to that, because it's always good to get some expert opinions on, instead of just having Dave and I. On that note, I don't think there's anything more for us to add, is there, gents? Anything else that you need to plug? I think that's about it.
That's about it.
I don't think so. I normally try to come up with a title, don't I, with trying to cover things. So whether we use it on this one or not, but we could go with constitutional rights scams and Essex bounty.
I had a different one, but I'll tell you about it.
Lengthwise, I might need some help with that one day to condense that one a little bit.
I've got a snappier one, but I'll tell you about it off air. Anyway, on that note, listeners, we'll let you get stuck into this session, and we'll see you all very soon. All right, good stuff. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I will be your host for this afternoon, but I'm by no means on my own. I am joined, as ever, by my colleague, Mr. David Holmes. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, Ollie.
Good afternoon, indeed. Nice to have you with us this afternoon. So just a little bit of admin before we get stuck into the main body of today's session. First of all, if you're new to this forum, well, welcome along. It's nice to have you with us. We hope you do enjoy it. This is a very informal podcast. It's an opportunity for us to come together as a privacy community and kick some things around. So as I said a minute ago, there's been some slight confusion. This is not, in fact, retention and archiving. That's what we'll be talking about next week. So we do hope you join us for that. But apologies this week, as I say, GDPR Radio, where we're going to be talking a little bit about what's been in the news from a privacy perspective, a little bit about what we've been working on, share some opinions, get some questions in perhaps from the guys on the session, and generally talk all things privacy. Before we get to that, a couple of elements. You will notice that this meeting is being recorded. That's how we put it out as a podcast afterwards. There's a privacy notice on screen relating to that right now. And then finally, what I really want to get across to you is that this is by no means our session. It is in fact yours, the listener. So please do get involved. Comments, queries, questions, concerns, anything at all, either pop them in the chat and I'll pick those up as we go along, or raise your hand, unmute, dive in. As I always say, it's best when we get some fantastic interaction, which we do pretty much every week these days, so please keep it coming. There are actually a few last bits that I wanted to raise before we get in, apologies. One of which is, if you do enjoy the podcast, why not leave us a rating? I'm going to pop a link in the chat right now to our Trustpilot page. Miles has got us trying to get all sorts of reviews for that at the minute, so if you enjoy, feel free to pop along and leave us a rating.
And just to qualify that, do drop all his and also my name in there as a bit of a shameless plug. It would really help to identify which sessions you like and so on. So please do feel free to drop our names just as a bit of a shameless plug.
Yes, please. And then finally, last thing is, I suppose, a little bit of a content warning, actually, just because this week there's a few news stories for those who are hot on the pulse of privacy matters that relate to abortion rights, notably in the US. There's also a story that we want to pick up about pregnancy and labor. Appreciate that those can be very difficult topics, so we just thought we'd let you know at the top, so that if you want to turn off now, then you've got the opportunity to do so. Right, Dave, on that note, let's get stuck into some privacy news. Let's start if that's okay, with the University of Essex data breach, since Mark has very kindly shared a link to that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it? Well, did you see this, first of all?
I'd seen it. There's been kind of blogs, and I think even our own esteemed masters produced a blog that I believe on our website now, is it? So if anybody wants to go and read it,
it should be.
Go to our website and pick up the esteemed master's kind of thoughts on that. So there's a blog.
Could you stop referring to Phil as our esteemed master? Such a strange title you've given him. Yeah, our very own Phil Bryan's written a piece about this University of Essex data breach. It's on the DP website if you want to read it. Sorry, Dave. Please do go on.
No worries. And so there's been a bit of out there, but it was a maintenance team email containing a spreadsheet of 400 students, their names, student IDs, dates of birth, contact details. And it's presumed that they're all kind of CC'd or copied into the same email. The contact details about.
Well, yeah, sorry, just to say it. The news stories that I've read thus far, I don't know about you, but don't seem to indicate specifically how this information has gotten out. It talks about an email with a spreadsheet of 400 students. The assumption that we're making is that those students were inadvertently copied into the email, or that at least someone who shouldn't have been copied into it was in fact copied into it, or it was sent to the wrong person. Something to that effect, because otherwise we're not entirely clear on how it's got out, just to be clear.
No, for sure. And on a side issue that we can certainly talk around, I've often had issues with clients where they're sending out high volumes of emails through Outlook, and I always query, why aren't you using kind of a normal email broadcast platform for that? You get far better results, you get a lot better stats in the background. It delivers each email individually as opposed to courtesy copying everybody in, and it seems, considering how relatively cheap they are, in that sense, I don't understand why anybody would want to email in large volumes sending an email with large volumes of people courtesy copied in. It just doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you. Oh, sorry, Liz, it's just earlier on in the chat. I believe Mark shared it, but if not, I'll pop a link back in now. I mean, so basically, as you say, an email sent out by, I think, like maintenance staff or facility staff. I think it's a door in some like block of student flats that's been damaged and they want like people to pay for it. I certainly don't want to be flippant. I'd be curious to hear anyone's thoughts about this in the chat. But in the article I read, they interviewed the solicitor's firm who are representing these students in an action against the university for this. And I've got some verbatim quotes here that say the spreadsheet included on this email contained all kinds of crucial data on hundreds of people, so the seriousness of the issue should not be downplayed. Through our work, we have seen how breaches of this kind can have a big impact on those affected. The information in question is, you know, names, student IDs, dates of birth, and contact details. Now, this is probably not the point, and I appreciate that, but when I was a student, I'd be giving out that information on a daily basis to anyone who'd give me a student discount, right? Like, maybe I'm not getting it, but to me, it doesn't seem like... It's not the point. It is still a breach, and it shouldn't happen, but... Is it really that serious? Dave, you might feel otherwise, and some certainly probably will, but to me, that level of information... Dates of birth is probably the trickiest part in there, actually. That's probably the one that is, slightly more difficult, potentially from, an identity theft perspective. But even then, I mean, you know, that information is pretty readily available, I'd have thought.
You've got to be able to assess it in light of the risks to the individual, haven't you? And you're kind of looking at, well, what are the risks with the data and kind of going through that process of, what was the information? I mean, you've certainly got 400 individuals, so you've got a bit of an escalation there because you've got a lot of records, but how many variables in each individual? What's the likelihood that you could do something with that information on those individuals, that kind of thing? What's the risk involved to their rights and freedoms? In that sense, don't forget we've had some recent case law as well, haven't we, through I'm just trying to think of some of the names recently, but in relation to kind of in essence setting a de minimis level for compensation claims and so on. And so forth in relation to the level of harm and that kind of thing. There's a few working quick enough if I look.
Well, one of them certainly Lloyd v. Google, right? Which is that, you know, you have to demonstrate harm. So if they're talking about like 400 students, can they demonstrate that at least a certain number of those students have actually suffered harm. Because that's the thing, like, and part of the problem, and actually I've got a story which relates to this in a minute that I'll come to, but I think part of the problem a lot of time when we see these data breaches, and to be clear, because I think someone picked it up on this the other week, and rightly so, what we are certainly not doing when we talk about these actions for data breaches on this podcast is invalidating them as a valuable recourse for people. They're an incredibly important mechanism for individuals to hold organizations accountable, and I completely agree with that. The problem I find is that you all too often get these actions which are frivolous, isn't the word, but you know what I'm getting at, which is they're all almost disingenuous by certain angles, right? You know, people saying, oh, my email was disclosed to someone I didn't want, please can I have a couple of grand? No. So it's just worth pointing out that we're certainly not bashing it overall, but you do need to be able to demonstrate harm. That is the fundamental of a claim for damages, right?
Well, so, the law's clear in the fact that it's, you're not going to get compensation for merely a breach of the law. You're going to have to demonstrate harm. It's not as soon as something's happened, you're entitled to compensation. It's a harm-based approach. So like you say, you're going to have to demonstrate what was the harm. I mean, in your assessment of the risk, you're going to have to try and identify some of the harm. But if somebody's claiming compensation, they'll have to demonstrate a sufficient level of harm in order for it to be pushed through the court. The courts will entertain it, otherwise.
Yeah, that's quite right. So Ben's quite right saying it's a breach, but there isn't enough detail in the news to tell us why it would be high risk, and that's his view as a further education college DPO. Yeah, agreed. You know, we don't have the detail. And Mark kind of sides with both of us, saying that, you know, he was like me, giving out his details to everyone, which is not the point. I appreciate, but, you know, you've got to be realistic. But that you're quite right, Dave, that times are changing. And we have seen an escalation. Apparently, Toby says that Hayes Connor, so the law firm in question, I didn't name drop them, but I guess it's in the news story, so it doesn't really make a difference. Apparently, they've got a bit of a record with these types of no-win, no-fee type actions. Interesting. Well, according to Phil, he reckons it's a training issue, right, which is that it's probably someone in, not to stereotype, but it's probably someone who's part of a maintenance team. They don't handle a lot of data necessarily on a day-to-day basis. And so they've just, you know, pulled off the spreadsheet and lobbed out an email and sent it across, and it's gone wrong. I mean, I think that's probably a pretty reasonable explanation, don't you think, Dave?
To be fair, when you do root cause analysis, you do look at people, places, environment, that kind of thing. You look at all the bits and pieces going in there. So I would have said training would be one of the high issues on the fact that it's a training issue. Arguably, yeah. If it's a maintenance person doing it, should it be the maintenance person sending an email out? And there may well be organisational issues of who's actually authorised to send communications out on behalf of the organisation, that kind of thing. So you've probably got some other elements that you could throw into the mix.
Yeah, I think actually, to be clear, I'm being a bit unfair. It's not maintenance, it's facilities management, which is different. I think it's a block of flats owned by a particular company, which is presumably like let to all these students on an agreement with the university. And therefore they're saying, hello university, you've got all these students in here, someone's got to pay for this door. So just to clear that up, Joanne's saying that it's also very possible people put this information in the public domain themselves through social media, etc., therefore would the harm be reduced? Again, kind of the problem with that, and I do agree with what you're saying, and that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that these are students fundamentally, and again, not stereotype, but I remember my time as a student, not the most privacy conscious, let's put it that way. But again, how do you quantify that? If you're going through your breach assessment process, how do you quantify the level of risk to people? And also, how do you quantify whether some of them have put that? You can't know, I think, is the problem.
I was going to say, you've got to be very careful. You can't assume everybody has.
That's right.
So you might be able to go, well, the information may well be in the public domain. Students saw this information around all the time, that kind of stuff, when you're going through Freshers Week and different bits and pieces. But you can't assume that's everybody.
Yeah, and to be clear, there may well be people who residing in that block who there may be safeguarding concerns about. Like, there might be very valid reasons why people living in that specific block want to protect their identity or their location or their contact details. Lisa is pointing out the three-part test for negligence, which is way back in my law degree. But yeah, clearly talking about duty of care owed, was the duty breached, was there a loss? You also look at remoteness and things like that. That's interesting, because that's a negligence test, right, which is a tortious action fundamentally. I am not entirely clear whether this particular action against the university is being brought on tortious grounds. It might be brought under the compensation mechanism of the GDPR or the DPA. I'm not entirely clear, because that's one of the things, if for those on the session who regularly come up against these, because I've seen a lot of these types of claims. One of the things that normally stands out to me is that generally the law firms trying to bring them go with a very broad approach and try and bring sort of like up to like six different actions. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Dave, but
yes, sort of, I've experienced it with some of our clients.
They go the negligence route, they go the misuse of private information route, they go breach the DPA route, they go breach the Human Rights Act route, which is always quite funny to watch them argue. So yeah, interesting. Jeff posted some guidance in the chat from Waitman's about data breach litigation, which... Oh, I got muted there. I don't know if there's anything else to say on this, Dave, specifically. I think you may be muted. Yeah, someone did hit the mute all button. I don't know if that's just Mark. Yes,
I was. I don't think there's much more. Yeah, you've got to go through the process. Like you say, it's been reported. Is it a breach? Is it notifiable of the ITO? Have we got a duty to notify the individuals? That kind of thing. And when we're assessing the seriousness of the risk and the likelihood of harm, we've got to go through that process about likelihood of harm against their rights and freedoms that are protected and things like we've discussed and that kind of stuff. So you have to go through that. Unfortunately, the law says that you're entitled to claim compensation, but you do that through the courts, and you then got to bear in mind the case law and the changing case law. You're right there about Google. I was thinking about some of the other ones recently as well that had come out with case law kind of saying, well, actually, there's some out there saying, well, actually, it's only really a small claims, if anything. It's certainly not a high court case. Sure. And limiting claims management companies around the area, but also there were some other ones, and like I said, I'll try and dig them out if I can, around this de minimis level stuff beyond the Google, or refer to Google, but beyond kind of more recent cases than Google, looking at this minimis level of harm and that kind of thing.
No, sure. And I just wanted to make the most of a segue, because that guidance that Jeff has put in the chat, actually, one of the first things it mentions is a case that I wanted to bring up this week. Which is a case called, the name escapes me now, but it's basically, it's called Underwood and Bounty and Hampshire Hospitals. And effectively, so this, just to be clear, this is a slightly older case. I'm only bringing it up this week because someone happened as part of my network to share it. And I thought it was interesting, because I think we did talk about it when it first happened, but with a little bit of, setback now, it's interesting to see how this contributes to the development of sort of these, rules around trying to claim for damages. To cut quite a long and complicated short, although I'd urge you to go and read the judgment yourself. It's not massively long, the judgment, but it's quite complicated. I'll put the link to it in the chat here. But this is basically about a company called Bounty, who have subsequently gone into administration or gone bust. So basically their business model was marketing services to expectant mothers and then subsequently supporting them through being a new mum, right? And effectively, one of the things that they did was they'd collect your details, and when they collected your details, they would then sell those details on to some of their commercial partners. And they actually were the subject of ITO enforcement action. They were found to have, failed in their transparency and consent obligations. I think they were fined like under half a mil, something like that, for it. And basically this case has been brought because this particular person, so had signed up to the service, her details had therefore been sold on to the commercial partners. She'd then been through labour, and while she's on the ward postpartum, a representative for this company, this is apparently part of their normal strategy, this is how they work. There's a representative for the company wandering around the ward and basically engaging with the new mums, right? Engaging is an awfully kind way of putting it, badgering more likely. But basically, subsequently after that, the mum starts receiving targeted ads from these commercial partners and says, well, you must have sold my data. You must have got it while I was there on the ward. I'm going to sue you accordingly. And they were also trying to sue the hospital for granting this person access to the ward, saying that they failed in some of their obligations to keep data confidential and secure. Now, it's interesting for a number of reasons. One of them is that, first of all, it's worth saying, I think that the business model itself is pretty appalling. I really don't like it. I don't like it. There's something that really sort of sinks to me about sort of the way in which they were operating. But the, you know, there was ICO enforcement action. They were found to have, you know, breached their transparency and consent obligations, as I say. But actually, one of the things that comes out is that basically the trust have not been found liable, or the specific hospital have not been found liable in this case, because the campaign in that respect from this company Bounty was actually quite well designed, in that it was designed in such a way that details were collected beforehand, and they didn't really necessarily need too much information or any from the hospitals. They just needed access to the ward to be able to go and you know, bother all the all those on the ward. So in that sense, kind of the campaign, even if I really don't agree with it, was kind of well designed from that perspective. Obviously, they failed on the transparency and consent points, but otherwise they were pretty close to getting it, quote unquote, right. The other thing that is most interesting, though, in respect of what we were talking about, is the fact that, albeit Obiter, the judge in this case, basically said that one of the things they tried to claim for was exemplary damages, and against the hospital as part of this action to, you know, sue them for granting access to the ward in particular. And the judge said that it is never appropriate to include exemplary damages for distress, which is interesting, or at least in this particular context, it would never be appropriate. And actually, that's one of the things we see a lot of in these breach claims, is that people are trying to claim for distress a lot. Now, I'm not sure necessarily whether exemplary damages are folded into the ones I've seen previously, but it's interesting to see that development and basically putting the foot down and saying, you know, this isn't appropriate. I don't know if you saw this, Dave. I don't know if you've read it.
I think it's slightly
older now. I've been talking a lot. You talk a little bit.
The actual case itself, I had quite a lot of knowledge of. I didn't necessarily see it coming up in fully in this sense, but I'm fully aware of the case itself. Although I am a little bit bemused around the, I mean, I get the business model in that sense, but the ward allowing, in essence, somebody to say, I'll market my products to new mums if you just allow me on the ward. So I'm just a bit puzzled by that. If it's a service that would assist young mums, fine, but assisting young mums and possibly selling her data is two different things. You know what I mean, in that sense?
Well, so apparently, just to clarify, apparently part of it is that the hook, as they would say, from a marketing perspective, for sorry, I've just got a notification. This particular meeting is going ahead. Yes, I'm aware. I'm in it right now. The hook was that, you know, they go around on the ward, and I think they hand out some sort of like pack or something. I don't know.
They've normally got nappies and
that's right.
But it's I'm just still a bit bamboozled. Let's take it away from the young mums. Would the hospital or would the ward facilitate Foxy Bingo walking around and saying, well, look, we can entertain the patients because they're going to be here for a while, or you know what I mean, or something other. Why, you know what I mean? I get, yes, it's young mums. You might be able to help young mums, but and giving them products that may assist them in the early days of motherhood, maybe in that sense. I get that, but it's the actual taking the data to sell it on and that kind of stuff, which I really don't get. And I don't know whether the whole setup to me just feels like I'm not quite sure whether consent to sell the data would have been valid, quite frankly.
Well, no, it wasn't. It wasn't. That's the point. Rebecca's pointing out a few things, and thanks for this, Rebecca, because I must have missed particularly this first point, which is apparently there's a connection with benefits too in this case. A suggestion this was the process by which you access child benefit, which is really interesting, and I guess would kind of tie in with the broader theme that from a transparency perspective, it certainly wasn't good enough. And yes, that's right. There's a thing about offering like a free photo. So I think part of the thing is that the particular rep in question was sort of badgering the parents to take a picture with the baby, sort of saying, oh, you know, first family portrait, and they're saying, no, could you please go away? Do you know what I mean? Sort of. It now is not the time.
John, although it's so bitter, I can understand why they might be thinking, well, whoever gave the permission for somebody to walk around the ward doing this in the first place, yes, if it's look, you maybe benefits, then and we've got this pack that we can give you, fine. I've certainly got no issue with trying to help
new mums and packages and stuff like that, but it's the selling of the data afterwards and the tactics that are used. You know what I mean? It's just the whole lot seems to just stinks a little bit.
So what's key to point out is that the data harvested and the data sold on to the subsequent partners was obtained prior to going into labor, prior to any of that. So mum signed up for the service in advance, you know, while expecting.
But when it's being badged in awards?
How did
they sign up the first time?
No, this is what I'm saying. She proactively engages with the service while pregnant.
Okay.
At that point, they don't tell her that they're going to sell her data, but they do so. Subsequently, they come and badger in the ward and, you know, whatever. Mum and dad are under the impression that some of the data collected is at that point, right? They're under the impression that the data collected was there on the ward. Now, a small amount of it was, I think, that like the baby's name, for instance. But then, you know, subsequently, mum starts receiving these emails from partners. So presumably, that's a targeted thing, like the campaign's been designed in that way, right? Like there will have been some notification that went back to Bounty to say, oh, you know, mum's got healthy baby, etc. You know, you can start bombarding her with emails about stuff that she might be interested in. Presumably it's been designed in that way, let's be honest. And so that's part of it. And the key part in this judgment is the fact that actually the hospital didn't facilitate access to much, if any, information, or very little information. The information in question was collected prior to that when mum proactively engaged with the company. That's not to say that the collection of information was right. It clearly wasn't, because the ICO fined them and the consents weren't right to share the data. But this particular case hinges on the fact that actually very little information, or information of not great sensitivity, according to the trial judge in this one. Mm.
I'd also like to not suppose it's necessarily going to have a big influence on anything, but I'd also like to see what the Caldecott Guardian's thought was about the the individual actually being on the ward.
That's a good point.
Because the questions and the approach deployed by them.
Yeah, because outside of the data protection thing, like it just doesn't seem appropriate. Like that's exactly what you're saying. It just doesn't feel right. Doesn't feel right. Anyway,
definitely on the face of it doesn't.
Yeah, no. I just wanted to raise that because I thought there were some interesting bits and a connection raised it again this week. So, and there was a lovely segue from Jeff, so I thought I'd use it.
But how many times do we see it though, that the privacy notices aren't produced in the required format, but they're just not transparent enough when you're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And part of this, arguably, you're spot on, is that regardless of, because obviously we went into details there of the process and, you know, the timeline of events, but regardless of that, if mum feels that, you know, if mum feels this way, then clearly there's an issue from a transparency perspective, right? Because otherwise she'd have expected all of this. So regardless of whether it's right or wrong or at what point you do it, you've clearly got something wrong, because if you're doing things by the book, then people should expect the communications, and they shouldn't be, they shouldn't be taking you to court over it.
Bundled consent and all that kind of stuff. I'd have to go back to the time and see what it was, but I would certainly be interested to see what Bounty had actually told the individual at the point of sign up, or whether it's all this kind of legalese and a bit complicated, far too long. Look, several pages, you read through it in your own time, just say you're happy with it, and then you know what I mean, and all that kind of tactics.
Well, one has to assume that a lot of that was involved. Mark quite rightly picks you up on the particular choice of Foxy Bingo and says that other bingo sites are available. Please gamble responsibly. Thanks, Mark. You're doing my job for me at this point.
Product placement. Just getting out. I'm not being paid. There's no product placement needs.
I hope not.
Just get anybody sat there wondering.
Let's move on from this particular story. There's one which. She's on right now, but she won't talk to us. I know she won't, because she refuses to. Jasmine sent me earlier this week, which is interesting, because it's basically... Oh, was it Jasmine that sent me this? It was one of the sales guys, either way. A story in Bloomberg that the FBI last year used section 702 of FISA, which we've spoken about at length in the context of Max Schrems, etc., a total of 3.4 million times last year. So they made 3.4 million queries to inspect the private communications of individuals. Now, we were talking about this off air, weren't we, Dave? And there's a couple of things that are interesting about this. For you guys, listeners, generally Dave and I catch up a little bit before these sessions, and we end up sort of doing the session before the session. So I have to try and rein it in where possible. But we were talking about this, and one of the things that, well, first of all, wound us up was frankly the standard of the reporting, which is poor, because it's not been very well researched at all. The opening paragraph says that Section 702 was used in relation to 3.4 million US residents, which, Dave, if anyone's ever gotten anywhere near FISA, even read the full title of FISA, knows that that's not what it's about, right?
For sure, yeah. The FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it's aimed at non-US citizens or residents. So the fact that they used it 3.4 million times against US residents would seem like they're misapplying the law, or the reporters misinterpreted the law. And there may well be an applicable law, but it's just referred to the wrong one. The other thing that the article doesn't really indicate either is whether it's 3.4 million is a unique figure or a total figure. So they might have looked at one person 3.4 million times or looked at 3.4 million people once. We don't know.
Well, that's a very good point. My suspicion is that it's 3.4 million queries. So that's 3.4 million requests, but not necessarily 3.4 million people. Might have come a few times.
And whether the unique queries or is it just the total number of queries? So
that's also true. Yeah. So, but no, you're right. I mean, there's a misunderstanding about this, because then the article goes on to say that, and I quote verbatim, the report doesn't say that the activity was illegal or wrong, despite the fact that the article also quotes the specific section of the law. So I struggle to see how it's illegal if the specific section of the law is quoted, which enables it. But it's interesting to see these numbers. Apparently that's a number 3.4, which is more than doubled. I think it was one and a half million over the same period last year. We were saying off air, weren't we, Dave, that reading between the lines, it's probably to do with the rise of cyber attacks, and specifically two of the US's, shall we call them rivals, maybe? Well, I don't know, political rivals, maybe. Well, China and Russia, basically, let's be honest, that's who we're talking about. I suspect it's to do with that, but still, it feels like a lot, 3.4 million, because you're right. One of the things you pointed out there is that these requests relate specifically. There's a three-part test we discovered, didn't we? Which is that FISA requests can only be made in relation to non-US citizens who are not on US soil and who there is a belief that they are harboring sort of valuable intelligence, foreign intelligence. So it relates to non-US citizens outside the US, basically. So that's a lot. That's a lot.
Well, if it's non-US citizens outside the US, well, there's a lot of people outside the US, so that's fair enough. But if it's tailored through the three-part test you suggested, so the individual must have information of some form of intelligence that they're after, then 3.4 is a lot. Whether it's queries or people or unique queries or non-unique queries, it's still a lot of searches.
Yeah, it's
on a massive stuff that they targeting individuals for the intelligence purposes.
Yeah, it's a massive amount. It's massive. And I mean, you know, to an extent it might be reasonable, but it does seem like a lot. And in that context, it, you know, we think back to the Schrems 2 judgment and the issues that were raised around FISA. When you hear numbers like that, it's kind of easy to understand why that's a key aspect of that particular case, right?
I don't suppose the article really goes into it much, but does it highlight in any way how FISA is actually used? Do they have to kind of go through an approval process, or is it just a case of, well, actually, the FIA asked you bend over and hand it to them, that kind of, yes, sir, here you, or is there any kind, do they have the ability to refuse? Have they got the ability to, well, can you show me you've got authorization and who you're looking for and why and that kind of stuff? Or is it just a case of, can we have a look at your database? Yes, sir, here's my database kind of approach.
So that is a good question. The article itself does not. However, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a link to the report itself, which is the one which initially this article was written from, which is a report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, I think. Yeah, that's right. And yeah,
I'm not going to say nothing on this one.
What? Yeah, no. For the listener, we've been talking about this for the last, you know, week or so, and Dave keeps mentioning that he's not going to make a joke about, you know, National Intelligence or Office of National Intelligence and America generally. So he wanted me to point out that he won't make that joke. So for what that's worth, you've made me lose where I was then.
Just talking about the process of accessing information in the FISA.
Yeah, there's a very specific. So I looked this up because I did some transfer risk assessments. To use standard contractual clauses a while back, so I looked into it all, and there's a very specific approval process associated with these requests. Now, what it sounds like, if they're getting through $3.5 million a year, that process must be pretty fine-tuned at this point and pretty efficient. But there is an approval process for it. I think they have to go to something called the FISC, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Committee, maybe, something like that. But they basically have to get approval for these. It's not just something that they can just go ahead and do, which again is a misconception that the article in question makes, because it talks about not having a warrant, which they don't need. They don't need a warrant. They get approval for it, as I say, from the... No, sorry, it's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to review, I think. Maybe. Yeah, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. FISC. So they have to get approval for it. It's a regimented process, basically. Albeit it's a very efficient one.
And it may seem to that, but just kind of stating the obvious, but because it's foreign intelligence surveillance, it's actually kind of extraterritorial as well, isn't it? And that's the implications with TREMS and.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Sorry, I don't know if I cut you off there, but. Yeah, that's bang on. You know, it's all about foreign intelligence, and therefore that's why it undermines the GDPR. Because it applies, actually, it's a good point. It applies to specifically US companies holding that intelligence specifically, right? It applies to, so if you host your database on an Amazon server, an AWS server, even if it's in Ireland, because it's a US company, the FBI can request access to your files. That's how the FISA 702 works. We've spoken about it a lot, haven't we? But that's the essence of it.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was worth raising. It's quite interesting. You know,
interesting as well. Just linking to that as well. I can't remember which thing you came up with. I'm sure you came across it when we were doing transfer impact assessments. There was a US organisation that indicates apparently quite transparently how many requests from under FISA they've received, haven't they? So some are going that way.
That's a very good point. So there are, depending on the maturity of the business you might be dealing with. So if you're dealing with an American business, you want to send them your data. Depending on their maturity, they might publish these annual transparency reports, which state how many of these requests they've had, how many they've fulfilled, where they've come from, etc. Because it's not just FISA ones; they also get, you know, requests from courts, they get requests under subpoenas, etc. So there's all types of requests, and some companies will publish annual transparency reports, which basically state, you know, this is how many we got this year, etc., etc., etc. You might also find something which is recommended in the European Data Protection Board guidelines to the same effect, what's known as a warrant canary, which I think we discussed when we were talking about Schrems 2 and its implications, which is basically a contractual mechanism whereby the provider, if they receive, a warrant, the term warrant is used loosely, but it's not actually a warrant. It's a request under one of these statutory powers. Basically, they will tell you, you know, they'll reach out to you and say, oh, by the way, we've got this request in. And I don't know whether that gives you the time to withdraw any information that you've given to them, or I'm not entirely sure how warrant canaries work on that level, but that's what they are.
I think it'd be a bit tricky, to be fair, because do you ever actually fully delete data? You'd have to make sure that if you're going to remove the information from the systems before the request came in, you'd have to have some confirmation that it's fully removed, however that's done in a technical sense, in order so the FBI didn't get hold of it anyway. But let's say you received notification, you went, fair enough. It still undermines the GDPR, doesn't it? Even if they tell you, it's doesn't undermine it to you, it's a data subject. If the data subject's got no way to enforce the rights because we're non-US citizens, so they don't have the Fourth Amendment available to them, even if you're told that it's going to happen, it doesn't necessarily give the individual any more right.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. I mean, that's again one of the key things is lack of enforcement of rights, and also the lack of there being a regulatory body. There's no ombudsman, which is one of the things that was drawn out in Shrems 2. I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about this, but that's probably about it from me on this specific topic.
I think that's probably about it. Just what got me about it first when it first came up was just the volume, really. And you'd have thought, yes, intelligence companies do stuff, no doubt. MI5, MI6 are doing something similar, but it's just the scale of it, I think, for me.
Yeah. And even though I've been guilty of being a bit flippant and saying, you know, when we're doing transfer risk assessments, well, you know, if you run some, I don't know, local government initiative and you use MailChimp for it, what's the risk that your participants' data will be accessed under FISA? Probably pretty low, but you know, if you're looking at that sort of scale, actually the risk probably is maybe higher than I'm making it out to be. There's a couple other bits coming out of America that I think is probably worth talking about because there's been a lot of conversation about it this week. So we're going to tread relatively carefully here because there's a lot of subject matter which is not really for us to discuss. But I'm sure most of you will have seen that the US Supreme Court is set to overturn the decision of Roe v. Wade, which is a landmark American case to do with abortion rights. And there has been there are a couple of privacy elements to this, the first of which that decision, or at least the draft decision, was leaked in advance, which we can talk about a little bit in a minute. And also the fact that effectively this is a right which is at least related partially to privacy, in that it's all about private life and conducting your affairs free from interference, effectively. And it interlinks with a number of other rights which are also heavily focused on privacy. So we thought it was worth talking about it. But as I say, we're treading relatively carefully because obviously the subject matter of that and a number of the issues associated with it are not really for us to discuss, particularly not on this forum, even though we don't usually shy away from political matters, do we, Dave? We thought it best to try and, from an analytical point of view especially, try and steer clear of at least some of the subject matter involved in this.
No, for sure. So we're not necessarily going to be looking at the subject matter itself, but it's just looking around the privacy implications and reversing or potentially, shall we say, if it's kind of details after leak, certainly said it's not necessarily the court's decision, but it's kind of indicating what the outcome may be, that kind of thing. But we're just going to be sticking to those elements because it's obviously a very emotive topic for a lot of people and just trying to stay away from the real sensitive areas of that.
Sure. So basically, I mean, the first thing to discuss really, and it's one that we talk about a lot, we certainly spoke about it, if not for the past 2 weeks, because we've had some excellent episodes with special guests on, but the last time you and I were just on one of these forums, we spoke about it, which is a public interest element, right? So is it fundamentally in the public's interest for this decision to be leaked in this way? And then subsequently, is it in, I can't remember which I've gone for. Is it in the interest of the public for this to be leaked, but also is it in the public's interest?
And two different things.
Your favourite, right? So
what, two different things.
Two different things. So this is what we were saying off air, that regardless of where you come down on the issue in question, is it right for draft judgments to be leaked and potentially, you know, have public opinion influence those decisions?
I'd be concerned about how the leak came about because you'd have thought if it's a court decision, then leaking it early, would that not be contempt of court in that sense? You'd have liked to have thought that.
You'd have thought so, yeah.
You know what I mean? You've got this kind of concept, not necessarily just with the courts, but you've got this kind of concept where you can come to a decision in a bubble without that necessarily being disclosed. And then once you disclose what the decision is, then depending what laws affect that, then you might have to kind of give up some of the thinking behind it in that sense. But you've got the ability to make a decision in a bubble in that sense without it necessarily being leaked in that sense. So there's certainly wider implications for, well, how was this decision? Not necessarily just why, not whether it was it a public interest disclosure in that kind of sense. But how did it actually get to the point of the, if you want to class it as the decision making bubble, how did it ever get to the point that it was released before the decision's ready to be produced?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And actually, I think it's, well, I don't know actually how it came about. I've read a few news stories that sort of allege that someone involved in it basically just, you know, handed it out straight out to the press. But it kind of ties into something we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, which was in relation to someone interfering in a process where it wasn't really their place to do so. I'll refer you back to the episode of GDPR Radio 3 weeks ago now, where we talked a little bit about that. But that's kind of the premise, right, which is that ultimately someone has taken it upon themselves to leak this information to the press where it's not necessarily, well, it's certainly not their job, but it's not their position to do that, right? Like, there are processes in place. There's a very good reason that, as you said, that sort of bubble around the decision-making is maintained. And to impinge on that, even if you have the right intention, even if it's an intention which in theory I might agree with, is not acceptable.
And I think it needs to be kind of set aside, and I know it's not the same, but it's got to be set aside from whistleblowing where decisions may be made internally.
Yes, that's a very good point.
And that kind of thing. This would have been a decision that would have been made public because it's a court deciding on a court case that then going to make their opinion known as a consequence of sitting and deliberating about it. So the issue would have been made public anyway. Not saying that's a defence for letting it go early in that sense, but it's a decision that would have been going public. It's not a decision within a corporate that's not obligated to disclose stuff. It's something that would have been going to the public in its overall outcome anyway.
I think that's an excellent point, because all you've achieved here is to create controversy. Well, it's not that there wasn't controversy, don't get me wrong, but you've introduced jeopardy into the process where there was no need for it per se, because you, as you rightly point out, it was being published anyway. All that you've done now is potentially, I mean, the draft decision is made, right? So ultimately it's not like they're going to take another vote on it based on public opinion. So maybe the impact of it actually is not as severe as we're making it out to be, but that's kind of besides the point. You can't interfere. And it's interesting to see that this is, you know, becoming, well, I feel anyway, maybe I'm just being a bit naive, but I feel like this is becoming more common, this sort of type of vigilante action where you may leak information because it agrees with your specific worldview.
I think that's all it is. I know we started by saying about, is it public interest or in the interest of the public? And obviously coming back to separating those two. But if you were to do a public interest test on this, surely it would fail based on the ground that the information was going to be made public anyway. So you've released it early. Yeah. So is there a public interest in releasing information that would have been disclosed anyway early? Well, I'd have probably said that there isn't. And that there's due course and due process to follow. The information was going to be made public. You'd have been able to possibly see the vote went. If there's, I'm not completely of the case, but let's say there's seven judges deciding if and four said yes and three said no, that kind of stuff. All that I would have thought would have been part of the normal court process. So I'd have said you probably failed the public interest test, and therefore this feels more malicious than the fact that somebody just wanted to release it early.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it is interesting, this whole public interest aspect. The other side of this, which I think is probably worth mentioning, is that ultimately the right in question that's being spoken about. Now, the reason that this case is being overturned, just for anyone who's not read up on this, the reason that it's being overturned is because at the time, so the right in question, which is the right to abortion, is not one that is guaranteed by the US Constitution. And in Roe v. Wade, basically the court, in the current view of the Supreme Court, the court at the time overextended itself by equating that right to a constitutional one where that is not the case. So they are effectively overruling / reversing that ruling and saying that they shouldn't have proceeded on the basis that that right was one that which could be guaranteed by the Constitution, because it is not. Now, the problem with that is that the right in question, while it is not guaranteed by the Constitution, is also not regulated by law in, I think, about 22 US states, which means that from the moment that this decision is overruled in 22 states, the law changes, right? And this is actually kind of where it becomes a little bit difficult for you and I, Dave, because we don't understand necessarily the US legal system. As far as I understand it, and we were talking about this off air, ultimately it's a constitutional law system because they have their constitution. It's also federal. So they have different laws, you know, per state. And ultimately there are also, you know, there's also statute there. So it's very complicated, but that's the essence behind it. One of the concerns, particularly for some academics, is that it's not just this case that is at risk of being overturned. There are a number of other important landmark decisions, which again interrelate with privacy because they're to do with basically one of them is to do with contraception, one of them is to do with homosexuality, the other is to do with gay marriage, basically. And it's all to do with you should have that right to private life in your own home. So there's a privacy consideration to it. And the risk is, again, that in those cases, if you're talking about a right to privacy, which is not a constitutional right, one that is not technically guaranteed, and it can be reversed, and that there is no statutory protection for that right, that has to be a concern. So I think that's part of what this whole conversation is about, but as far as I understand it anyway.
I would probably agree with that, yeah. It's all about, in essence, kind of constitutional rights versus case law. Constitutional rights are guaranteed. Case law is subject to case law changing, isn't it? Ultimately.
Yeah.
And I know in part of the output or part of the leaked information, I think one of the judges had indicated that the case was fundamentally flawed in that sense, and that's possibly why it's the looking at overturning it. But it's you're right, it's potentially this kind of quasar right through case law, not a constitutional right.
Yeah, and this is where there's a broader issue which is very difficult, where, because if I say right now, should privacy be a constitutional right, should it be guaranteed, obviously everyone on this forum is going to say yes, or at least, you know, broadly agree with that, because we're privacy people, right? But it's a right which is very difficult to guarantee in that way, because it's not catered for necessarily. So obviously in this country, you'd have an expectation of privacy based on a common law precedents, but also on things like Article 8 of the Human Rights Act, wouldn't you? But then that
I was just going to say, it's always difficult when you're kind of trying to compare laws from different countries, because we haven't got a written constitution.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
In that sense, whereas what we're referring to in the US, although it's possibly the case itself is maybe not covered by the constitution, but constitutional in law in the US is a documented thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that they have a constitution, yeah. Yeah. But again, this is where it becomes difficult, because rights, certain rights anyway, and privacy is one which is interesting, where it can't necessarily be absolute, because, and as we see, and this is kind of the inherent tension in the issue, is that sometimes, for very specific reasons, you have to impinge on someone's right to privacy. Usually for law enforcement reasons, but not exclusively. And also, you know, there is a tension that's inherent there, right? So it's not something that you can inherently for sure guarantee as an absolute right.
Would it conversely though be rather restrictive if it was an absolute guaranteed right in the constitution? Because what happens if you haven't got the ability to let's say make a decision or the capacity to make a decision, but you've got a constitutional right to privacy, but then how's that overridden by greater welfare rights and somebody doing something in your best interests?
Well, that's very true, because we even come across on, you know, sort of the very small scale of sometimes you, particularly in social housing, sometimes you share someone's data for what you perceive anyway to be their own good, whether it's from a safeguarding perspective or whether it's to, you know, facilitate a benefits payment, whatever it might be. And the tenant might not agree with that.
You know, they might say,
or a wider public. Yeah. But they might go, well, how dare you share my information with the council? I never allowed you to do that. And A, you have to go through the process of saying, well, actually, the law allows us to do this X, Y, Z. Although, if the tenant's not aware, it raises questions about your transparency, but that's by the by. But you have to go through the process of saying, you know, you don't have an automatic right to privacy. You don't, well, at least not
an absolute right.
An absolute, sorry, yeah. You do have an automatic, not an absolute, that's right. But you don't have that absolute right. There are instances where we need to infringe upon that because, you know, and the worst part being that a lot of the time it's you, usually, particularly in the context I'm talking about, in the individual's interest, you know. So it's incredibly difficult, and that's why cases like these, I think, while the subject matter itself obviously is certainly not relevant to us, it's important to use it as an opportunity to think about the rights that are relevant to us, you know. I think
data protection protects fundamental rights, doesn't it? Or gives effect to some fundamental rights.
Sure.
That kind of, because that's one of the things we look to. If there's been a breach, we look at how is it going to impact our fundamental rights. So looking at the wider elements around the case that we're discussing at the moment, well, it has an impact on your fundamental rights and how fundamental rights might be affected moving forward, not necessarily directly through data protection, but moving forward. Very similarly with the Ministers of Justice kind of review to Human Bill of Rights and the Human Rights Act, and that's got a fundamental impact on how human rights or rights could be perceived on depending what the details of all are and so on and so forth. So it's useful to look a little bit wider than just, well, what does the GDPR do? Look at how the law's changing around it, the impact of that. And if it fundamentally resonates within you, feel you need to share your thoughts and opinions on it, then use this forum if you want to use this forum to do that, or go to consultations on the project and start sharing your thoughts and feelings at appropriate consultations on why things are changing and that, and get your voice heard.
So, yeah, and actually that's an excellent parallel you draw there, because we've spoken a number of times about these potential changes to the Human Rights Act, and particularly within an immigration context. I spoke a couple of weeks ago about Project Sunshine, everything around that. And if those of you who've been with us for a certain amount of time cast your minds back, we've also spoken about in the past when we were looking at whether the UK would get adequacy. One of the things that potentially was a barrier to that is that there's an exemption under one of the schedules of Data Protection Act, Schedule 2, presumably, which provides for exemptions from parts of the law where it's for immigration purposes, right? And regardless of how you feel about that, the Europeans certainly didn't agree with that. They felt that that was fundamentally undermining some of the rights guaranteed by the GDPR. And
my understanding on the latest of that is that the UK has lost that and they've now got to change that.
Really?
Put something to change that effect, yeah.
That's interesting. But again, you know, because that's the thing, the risk is that sometimes when we talk about privacy and we talk about, you know, data protection, whatever, that we end up in a little bit of a bubble. But really, as you rightly say, Dave, you have to look further afield, because if we take that immigration exemption point and we, you know, look at it devoid of its context, then arguably it may not be that big of a deal because you change it or whatever and you get your adequacy, basta, you don't need to talk about it again. But if you take it in context and you look at then changes to, as you said, the Human Rights Act, you look at what's happening with, as I said, Project Sunshine, etc., then all of a sudden, you know, we're not talking purely about privacy. We're talking about, you know, really, really serious and complex issues. So it's important to take a wide look at it.
For sure, and especially with the immigration element that you referred to, the exemption and the, it's often going to be used against the most vulnerable in society, isn't it? You're not talking about somebody who's naturally trying to find work in a different country or going there on holiday. Generally, you're talking about people who may be picked up through trying to come to the UK through claiming refugee or other kind of status and that kind of stuff. So you're talking about the real vulnerable of society in that sense, and the people that we should be protecting, and you're just removing further rights from them.
And I think in that sense, there's probably quite a pertinent parallel to draw back to Roe v. Wade on that front. Unless you've got anything to say, Dave, I would like to bring that particular section of the podcast to a close, because I think we've navigated it relatively well. Listeners, do give us your feedback. But I think we've done okay on navigating that issue. I'm aware that we've run over already by a couple of minutes in terms of the allocated time. Obviously, in terms of the general podcast. We started a couple of minutes late, so I'm happy to do another couple of minutes. But I do appreciate that people will have to get off.
Yeah, no, for sure. Just on a lighter note, there is something I just wanted to kind of just really cover off on a lighter note, because I appreciate the last couple of topics have probably been a bit heavy.
Yes.
And we tried to navigate that well. It comes back to a point, really, and I used to work in direct marketing many years ago, and it comes back to a point that was made through a great guy. You can follow him online if you see him, a guy called Drayton Bird, and he's a real advocate for people reading and reading stuff. And I would really advocate anybody who's in the arena at the moment, anybody trying to get into privacy, anybody that's only just starting out, go and read. Read beyond the GDPR, read beyond the normal gumph that you get from regulators and that, or our regulator, not all of it's gumph, but go beyond the normal kind of stuff. Get yourself on blogs, get yourself looking at other jurisdictions and stuff. And the reason why I said about other jurisdictions is because for those who are listening in from different parts of the world and stuff, it's currently Privacy Awareness Week that's being pushed and promoted quite highly in Australia and New Zealand. And there's a lot of good material out there to go and have a look and around, go and have a read. You'll see similarities with the GDPR. You'll see them referring to the UK, to the ICO. Some of the documents from the ICO, you'll see similarities with the Convention 108 elements in there. You've got a lot of them are pushing out some really good material just to help expand your knowledge. So if the only plea I can give anybody just before they sign off is get yourself out there, read what's being published by different jurisdictions, pick up on things like Privacy Awareness Week and just see what freebies you can get, because there's always some really good golden nuggets in there that you can pick up on.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And we used to have a segment on this show a while back, which was where making use of my French language skills, I'd go and raid the CNIL website and see what was relevant or interesting. We stopped doing that because it turns out you can't really do that every week. But we might bring it back because you're right. It's fascinating to take a look at what other regions, other regulators are saying. And to draw those comparisons.
Yeah, so like the Australians, for example, are in a summary about their privacy management programs, the organisation should, and they've got real kind of draws to the GDPR, but you should clearly document and regularly review your practices and procedures to ensure the outline measures that are in place to manage privacy risks. Well, that's not massively different to what we do, surely. Implement mandatory privacy training for all staff, as well as contractors and casual hires, including annual refresher training. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's some great kind of similarities coming through.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't have too much more to add on that. I appreciate that people are having to get off now. So there were two other things that we were going to talk about this week. We sort of run out of time. One of which was that the FCA Financial Conduct Authority have published is it guidance this week or they've issued a warning rather, I think.
It's a report that's concerned about screen sharing because there's been a rise in scams targeted at people through sharing screens through online platforms, that kind of thing.
That's right.
It doesn't, the report is on the BBC, it doesn't say Teams or Zoom, but those kind of platforms, those are the things, sure, that we're talking about, where you've got the ability, if somebody's coming across as rather confused, for the person masquerading as somebody with financial advice, well, look, just let's share your screen, let me take over your computer, let me set it all for you if you're having trouble and that kind of stuff. And as a consequence of that they're putting viruses, they're putting all sorts on the systems, or seeing what else they can access. And it was staggering in the report that I think it said from January 2021 until now, it's like £15 million or something that's been taken as a consequence of these scams. So really trying to raise awareness of such scams through that kind of stuff. And for me, the two pertinent bits for me that was really kind of interesting, one was relating to, well, how many organisations have actually considered the risks associated with using Teams, using online platforms, having the share function or the ability to control somebody else's
machine and it, what control measures I might put around that. Not just around personal data, but also around commercially sensitive data and how we make sure we're not overly disclosing that. Has anybody gone through that? Has anybody thought about that? The other bit that I'm also really, really keen on is when you look at training, we often talk about protecting the rights of data subjects, making sure the organization's secure and things. And I think one of the big bits for me is that we need to start thinking about how to get people engaged with data protection. And one of the key ways for me, really, is talking to people about a subject that they talk a lot about, which is themselves. So can we make data protection relevant to them, get them talking about themselves, and whether there's any grifts of kind of welfare or even kind of a corporate social responsibility to have awareness raising about, well, we're not just talking about passwords at home, sorry, not passwords at work, we're talking about how you can fundamentally protect yourself at home. Be careful of scams, and just awareness raising around cyber threats that are going around, whether it's scammers on the telephone pretending to be from Microsoft, I know you've got a problem with your laptop, let me sign in, and that kind of thing, through to or even more modern now because of the Financial Conduct Authority publishing reports, and actually the doing it through sharing screens and being able to take control of somebody's laptop through kind of collaboration portals.
While those are all very good points, Dave, you really are taking the mic. I was just going to mention that and move swiftly on, but you've taken the opportunity to give us 5 minutes worth of content on it.
Just to show that I can speak for 5 minutes without breathing. I think that's the problem.
I don't think anyone doubted that, your ability to do that. I don't want to be too harsh on you because I said something a bit mean, and I made a bit of a mean joke this morning in our morning catch-up, so I'm trying to be nicer to Dave. But, yeah, I don't think anyone doubts the fact that you can talk for 5 minutes without taking a breath. On that note, any final thoughts? And I must warn you that I'm going to limit you to only a few minutes.
My final thoughts are, well, I thought it was a good session, but my final thoughts really was around all of it is just read and kind of consider, kind of think outside the box a little bit. Just watch what's changing, consider what's changing, query what the impact of that might be, and just try and kind of broaden your horizon a little bit and just read blogs, read documents, read case notes, read case journals and anything else you get your hands on, and that will make you a far more rounded privacy professional.
I think that's excellent advice, and I will echo that to close the session. So on that note, let's bring it to a close because we've got to bounce and record the intro to this and then I've got another meeting at 2. But no, thank you very much, Dave, for your time and your insights. I think that was very interesting, albeit not the most light-hearted session, but it's important to talk about these topics, as you rightly say. It's important to consider the wider impact, and ultimately, the hope is that it makes us all more rounded privacy professionals, as you quite rightly say. So thank you very much for your time and your insights this afternoon. Thank you to all those attending live. We very much appreciate your time as well and your input. We will be back next week for those who enjoy them. We will be talking retention and archiving next week with Carrie. As I mentioned at the start of the session, there's a slight confusion about invites, but those will be going out again this afternoon. We're really excited about that one because, as I mentioned, Carrie has, I believe, a degree in records management / archiving. So I think she's going to be a fantastic resource to talk to next week. So we do hope you join us all for that. And other than that, I think that's going to be it for us, Dave.
I think so. But thank you very much. And we look forward to meeting you again soon.
Absolutely. Have a good weekend, all.